Hello and welcome, everyone. I'm Dr. Chris Cannon from the Brigham and Women's Hospital in Boston. And on behalf of CME Outfitters, I'd like to welcome you and thank you for joining today for this Q&A session that accompanied the educational activity, Keeping the Beat, Screening and Management of High-Risk Patients with Non-Valvular Atrial Fibrillation. Online, we already have, I think, about 15 questions that have come in. So do submit a question. There's a little button on the screen that can do that. Or on Twitter, you can type in with the hashtag NVAFBeat, and we'll be monitoring that. I have it going, but someone else will copy over your question, and we'll try and cover that. So with that, I'll just start out to say that we had a wonderful discussion for people who have seen it or seen part of this with a colleague that talked about both screening and management of patients with non-valvular, or I'll just say atrial fibrillation. It's a fast-moving field and one that is growing in prevalence. I think that somehow every other patient I see has atrial fibrillation, and this is true in the hospital and very frequently as outpatients as well. And so lots of different topics to consider in who to do additional screening for people who have palpitations, say, or how to manage them, dosing details on the novel anticoagulants, special populations of those who've recently had a PCI. So lots of different areas to cover. And we covered in about an hour and a half, I think, all of the different topics, and so do encourage you to download the user guide that has all the slides, and it was a wonderful discussion. So I suppose I'll just take things in order, and the very first person asks a good practical question of what drug interactions do we need to consider when choosing anticoagulation therapy? And so this is a key thing in cardiology of drug-drug interactions, and one where turning to colleagues in pharmacy is one of my greatest joys because they always will have all the details. But going quickly online can also make sure there's no interaction. And fortunately, our EHRs often will alert us to that. But ketoconazole and other of the azoles are the big thing to worry about. And I actually went and had to quickly look up what would be the interactions. And PGP agents or substrates, rather, and strong CYP3A4 inhibitors such as ketoconazole are the things we think about. And it's really only if you have both of those, I think, that you have to adjust the dose. And it's pretty rare to be on ketoconazole or those other agents, so that's less common of an issue. More common, however, is renal dysfunction. And so that becomes a mega factor that needs very close attention. And so looking up and seeing what the eGFR is a factor that leads to adjustment of the dose in several of the anticoagulants, the novel ones. And then age and body weight are two other factors that relate to drug levels, as you'd expect of, how much of the drug is cleared that goes down with age. And then low body weight makes perfect sense that one would start to think about lower doses. And so that's a much more important factor and a key one, so that you can't just say, oh, let's give, pixaban or rivaroxaban and walk away, that you then have to say, okay, what's the right dose? Because there's a myriad of different doses for atrial fibrillation by renal adjustment or sometimes body weight, but then other doses for long-term therapy in venous thromboembolism that are lower. And so in the program, we do call out the fact that many of our older patients, you think, oh, let's avoid bleeding, let's use a lower dose. But that's actually often a wrong approach. If you simply say, let's use a lower dose that would be one for renal adjustments, that you would underdose and really not provide sufficient protection. And so there have been large registries that have found higher mortality and stroke rate in people who are inappropriately given the lower dose. So if you have renal dysfunction or low body weight or older age, the drug levels, when you give a lower dose, will be similar to that of a regular dose. And so you're just trying to make sure you're giving the right dose to get a full therapeutic anticoagulant level. So this is a very key point to focus on. So a little bit less on drug-drug interactions. You know, certainly have to double-check that, but a close look here. So someone writes in, what dose would you recommend for a female patient who's greater than age 78, 105 pounds, or a male over 80 and 150 pounds? My point is, what is the low end of the dose for NOACs? So those body weight and age are two of the three factors for apixaban that can get considered. And so age 80 and less than 60 kilograms, which is, I think, about 130 pounds, are the cut points. And so you actually have to look at that, and then the creatinine is the third factor. Other drugs use just the EGFR as the renal adjustment factor. So this is where you actually have to stop, pause, plug in the exact data for the drug you're going to use and get the right dose. So I think an excellent question that I, you know, I'm happy someone brought up. Another related question comes into, what about other comorbidities? And a big one, no pun intended, is obesity. But diabetes and COPD also are listed in this question. So obesity is kind of the opposite end of the spectrum, obviously, of low body weight, where we do adjust downward. And so you wonder, well, should you adjust upward or do some different dosing in obesity? And so far, the data are relatively limited, but, you know, for people with a BMI above 40, that using just the standard dose seems to have reasonable effects. And it's not been studied too carefully, but there are some PK data, and so there's generally not a huge adjustment for obesity. I think if there is concern, obviously using warfarin and then adjusting to the INR is an option. If say someone has a BMI of 50 and just, you know, extremely morbidly obese, and I believe there are at some labs, and we may have at the hospital recently, you can actually measure 10A levels to try and guide therapy. So in the extreme levels, you know, one could think about either warfarin or checking the level and adjusting the dose. So again, you know, a key question to try and get the dose right. And you know, in part, we've learned this question, this issue with overdosing, you know, with heparins or 2B3A inhibitors back, you know, a decade or two ago, that we very frequently will give too high a dose and then create excess bleeding. And so definitely want to try and avoid that. I think while I'm on the topic, another question just came in of, are NOACs safe for use in the very elderly? And so answer, yes. And, you know, part of the issue, though, is to make sure you get the dose right. So very often the very elderly will have borderline renal function. So when you calculate their EGFR, it can often be pretty low. And so you have to then calculate and look and see if it's less than 30, you start to hesitate. Although with apixaban, even in EGFR less than 30, it seems to be well tolerated in registries, et cetera. For dabigatran, outside of the United States, all the labels will say if you're age 80 or older that they recommend the lower of the two doses that are available, the 110 dose as opposed to the 150. In the United States, just the 150 milligram dose is available and approved for atrial fibrillation. You can actually get 110 for DVT prophylaxis, but it's not approved by FDA because they say the stroke reduction is better with the higher dose. But we did study that a little bit in the most recent study, Redual PCI, and in the few patients in the United States who did get 150 in that clinical trial, there was a bit of bleeding. It was very few patients. But a reminder, really, that the global recommended dose in those over the age of 80 for dabigatran is the 110 dose. So I think calling out that age is an important factor. I guess while we're sticking with different patient groups, someone asked, what about patients who are having dental oral infections or cleaning? And here, I think, relation to procedures is what's calling to mind, that if people are having teeth cleaning, and had someone earlier this week, do I need to stop my NOAC? And answer, no. But for broader procedures, there are algorithms in each of the things that are tagged, again, to renal function, to usually stop 48 hours before a larger procedure, say surgery or knee surgery or something. And then in older patients or borderline renal function, often 3 days to make sure that things really wash out. Let's see, I guess another related question someone asked, a female patient, BMI greater than 36 with hyperlipidemia and atrial fibrillation, counseling on diet and exercise, how do you do both? I think certainly those two things are probably unrelated, but although high BMI has been seen to be a risk factor increase of the incidence of atrial fibrillation, I think there isn't any particular relationship that one would have to alter the lipid diet or the exercise. And certainly I have to remind myself to do my proper exercise. And sitting home and being close to the cabinet with all of our desserts is something that one has to counter with better exercise programs overall. I guess the most recent thing, I'll try and get back to the earlier questions, is any option for monitoring therapeutic levels. So there are, although there's not a clear guide on how to use them. So anti-10A levels for three of them can be measured, the 10A inhibitors. But as one knows, there's variability in any drug that you give, beta blockers or heparin, obviously we deal with all the time of the variability. And so the trials have all been done with a fixed dose that has that big range. And so it's not clear, would titrating a level to a certain therapeutic dose level has been shown. I think the use is often for patients who are extremely morbidly obese, where you're worried about vast underdosing. So if you give, say, a standard dose to someone with a BMI of 45 or 50, if the drug level is, say, half of what it should be, that would be the worry and a way to use therapeutic monitoring. I think another topic that comes up, and I briefly mentioned, in people who have had PCI, and this was something we actually didn't get to cover in the program, so that patients need generally dual antiplatelet therapy with aspirin and clopidogrel or sometimes the newer agents. What do you do about anticoagulation? And so there have been now 5 trials, 1 with warfarin, 4 with each of the different NOACs, that have each shown that dual therapy of dropping aspirin, so keeping the P2Y12 inhibitor, usually clopidogrel, and the anticoagulant, is safer with a marked reduction in bleeding on the order of like 35% to 50%, without any increase overall in thrombotic events. There's been seen in high-risk ACS patients an early trend, although not significant, for higher stent thrombosis. And so one tries to think about, in the very high thrombotic risk patient, would you continue triple therapy, say, for a week or maybe a month? And so that is something in the current guidelines. There'll be a new one coming soon, of an update of the North American recommendations, to really consider doing triple therapy in very high thrombotic risk but low bleeding risk. And so I do that in, say, left main stents, or I had the most recent I can think of was someone who had like three different stents in each artery, and was a 45-year-old or something, who had had an acute coronary syndrome. And so that patient extended a month of triple therapy and then went down to the dual therapy. So that's been a really nice advance. And the quick concept is that for the atrial fibrillation, you keep the anticoagulant as a key component. So let me turn a little bit now to some of the topic on screening. And this was a topic that we covered, and there are lots of new tools, and every week there's a new device or wearable that's coming out. And so we are faced with this of, where do we use these? And so a question that someone's typed in of when do you use, which patients would you use a patch ECG monitor instead of a Holter? And that would be largely a longer duration, and asking of different types of Zio patch, Cardiostat, or Nuvant, are there differences? And then what about the insurance coverage and access or patient preference to these? So I think the use of longer-term monitoring is one that I'm doing more and more, because a Holter is usually 24, sometimes 48 hours. And I found that it becomes a terrific therapy, and that the minute you put the Holter on, there are no more palpitations. And then you take it off, and then they start back up again. So you miss any event that a patient's been reporting. And so using, say, a 2 or a 4 week monitor gets rid of that issue, and you get a better sense. And so each hospital or practice probably has access, because of insurance issues or billing or whatever, to a different type of monitor. Whatever is available, we sometimes get the Zio patch, and it seems to work well. And we have some different ones, at our hospital, but it doesn't really matter. They're all basically the same, that you get the longer-term monitoring. This comes up often if someone's had, say, an ablation and they're 3 or 6 months out. You want to make sure that they really haven't had any further recurrence in a patient who wants to stop anticoagulation. It's generally recommended to continue it and have it based on the CHADS VAS score, but many younger patients especially will want to try and stop. And so getting a month of monitoring to make sure that during that period there's nothing going on. The other setting is if people have vague palpitations and their ECG has sinus rhythm, and you're like, So I'm thinking of another patient recently seen who did a long-term monitoring and turned up, she had 12% AFib. And so we've kept her, thankfully, because we had her on anticoagulation already. So I want to do a quick call out to Twitter that we're getting wonderful questions from Twitter, I guess one of the questions here asks, of the different NOACs, how do they differentiate with safety? I think here, you know, there are some differences in the main trials of the NOACs versus warfarin as strategies. The doses selected, you know, and the dosing regimens impact. So I guess the first trial was with dabigatran. There were two doses, the 110, 150. And so broadly, the 150 had similar bleeding rate to warfarin, but the 110 had lower bleeding risk, although, again, that's not approved in the U.S. Then rivaroxaban had similar bleeding. You know, it's given once a day, and so has a higher peak and then lower trough, and so it didn't have an advantage on overall bleeding. Apixaban did have a significant reduction in bleeding, and I think that, I think, has made it really capture everyone's attention. I think it's the most prescribed, probably because we want to avoid bleeding. And then edoxaban is also, it had two doses, but the approved dose had roughly similar bleeding overall. So, you know, there are some differences amongst the different agents that can be incorporated. Someone asked about smoking and NOAC dosing. I don't believe there's any impact there. Then getting back to the devices, what about the Apple Watch? You know, we talked the definitive thing, and actually in the Apple Watch study, if you had a sign of potential atrial fibrillation on the watch, they'd send you a two-week Zio patch, I think, to try and confirm that. I have found a lot of people have the Apple Watch, and unfortunately, there's a disconnect with the population that has atrial fibrillation versus the population that gets an Apple Watch, but the latter are usually younger people who exercise a lot, and the those with AFib are generally older. You know, the incidence increases markedly age 70 and up. So there, I think with the Apple Watch, it can be useful as sort of a screening tool. And, you know, selected patients that fall into the middle range of the people in their 60s who have had some AFib, they can use the Apple Watch or a similar device. The Alive Core device is another one that's you put your two fingers on and get a nice tracing. So those are, I think, a useful adjunct that, you know, can be help overall in finding whether palpitations that patients have are episodes of atrial fibrillation. I think another topic that someone wrote in early on was what about rate control and use of drugs and versus rhythm control and ablation. And this is a hot new area with the release of the EAST, I think if I've got it right, AFTAX or four study, and apologies to that group for mangling their acronym, but this study looked at new onset atrial fibrillation within the past year and compared rhythm control giving drugs or ablation versus the more standard rate control of anticoagulation was used in both groups. And they found a lower incidence of cardiovascular events in pursuing a rhythm control strategy. And so ablation was about 20% of that strategy, and then drugs like amiodarone or sotalol, et cetera, were used in the other 80%. And so that has been a big change in my practice. I think a lot of times people are symptomatic, and so you pursued rhythm control to help avoid symptoms. But here now it's been seen to actually improve cardiovascular outcomes. I think at our institution we turn relatively quickly to ablation as a strategy there. A good question here, how has the pandemic changed management? Do you change switching people from warfarin to NOACs if they're eligible to reduce need for INR monitoring? It's an excellent question. I think we obviously are all doing more virtual visits, and someone else writes about, you know, how do you do a telehealth thing if you can't listen to someone's heart or take their pulse? You know, here, blood pressure cuffs will give you heart rate, and often any device will give heart rate. And so if it's really high, that could be a signal it might be atrial fibrillation. Or if you have a smartphone app that could do a rhythm analysis, that can be very helpful. And so trying to figure out how to incorporate the home devices to get a good read is important. I know for our longer-term monitoring devices, they're now just sent to the patient's home, and so the patient sets them all up at home with the instructions, and they don't come into the office to get any of these devices overall. I guess another question someone writes in is, who's an ER doc, how do we manage patients in the ER when they present with AFib? Do we stop the anticoagulant? You know, there, if it's a bleeding episode, then generally one does. There are antidotes to the 10A inhibitor or a monoclonal antibody to dabigatran that are options for severe bleeding, or people who have to go off for emergency surgery if they're in a big car accident and are on one of the NOACs, that those are options. And I think most hospitals have both of those antidotes available now. I guess another question here of, you know, in the diagnosis phase, what do we do? And certainly doing a good physical exam if we are seeing patients you know, EKG obviously is a routine part of a cardiologist visit, but as we explored in primary care, it's not necessarily a part of every single primary care visit. And so there, checking the pulse, you know, is a what was called opportunistic screening, so that you have some reason to think, gee, I should check on this patient. They're 70 years old. You know, would they have, if they complained of palpitations? It's, you know, useful to remember that, you know, the physical exam, when we can do it, is a key part of overall management. I guess another question on women and heart palpitations. You know, both men and women get palpitations, and in the screening process, I think it is helpful to start with an EKG, you know, obviously ask about the pattern. Very often people will say, oh, I get an extra beat or a single extra beat here or there, and that's more often atrial premature beats or ventricular ones. So I always ask, you know, are they extended periods or do you get lightheaded at all? And when that happens, then you start to think about, gee, maybe I should do some type of monitoring. As we've discussed, to try and get a sense of, is there actually atrial fibrillation? Certainly looking at other risk factors, if it's an older patient, et cetera. Final question, medication adherence, how do we help? And so I think that we play a big role as healthcare providers saying how important it is to make sure to take the anticoagulant either once or twice a day, depending on its dosing, or following through with the INR monitoring, as my mom does, because she's on warfarin. And so, you know, that is a key thing that we can call out to make sure patients are, you know, following through. Because if you stop the medication, some people do it inadvertently, especially if they've been skipping visits because they don't want to come see the doctor, that they realize that you instantly lose protection if you stop me. So I think this has been a wonderful discussion here, and thank everyone for the great questions that have come in. Unfortunately, it's already 12:30, and it's a delight to have participated in this program. I want to remind you of the SMART goals that the CME Outfitters have, and from this program, they've been to choose an appropriate screening strategy for patients and try and match the screening technology to the patient, as we touched upon briefly. Appropriate anticoagulation with the appropriate dose is a key thing that and to not underdose inadvertently, but to really make sure and pay attention to the dose. I think the rhythm control strategy for early onset of atrial fibrillation patients is a new thing that we have to consider. And then shared decision making and reinforcing adherence and persistence is really a key factor, because patients can only get the benefit of these drugs if they're taking them. So I want to thank everyone and again remind you that all of the resources and the slides and things and additional patient resources are available on cmeoutfitters.com. So thank you all for joining and stay safe, everyone. Hopefully this can be helpful for caring for our patients. So thanks very much.